day, actually it's never any day, that I get recognized by my voice alone. But it was a day yesterday when Sam of Ask an Atheist of Sam Mulvey was recognized by voice alone. You are listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam is taking a break today because we had quite a day yesterday where I, Becky, and Sam went to the Mike and Key Amateur Radio Club Electronics Fair. Electronics swap meet? Flea market. There we go. That word. And none other than a longtime listener, John from Boise, said, as we were passing by some of the tables, Sam Mulvey from the podcast. And we turned around and said, yes. And it was a really fun little moment. So shout outs to John and his crew from Boise that had made the trek all the way over to Western Washington for an electronics swap meet. You know, ham radio, Sam talks about it. It's one of his passions as in addition to terrestrial radio and all sorts of audio and recording. And I'm sure that he'll be on in a subsequent week to talk about his awesome and amazing haul. But for right now, you got me, Becky, in the studio here at Ask an Atheist. And Dan's here as well. How you doing, Dan?
Not as identifiable as Sam, apparently.
I guess not. And Josh, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. I would actually absolutely disagree with that. Everybody knows Dan's voice.
Oh, is that the case? Is that really the case?
Oh, yeah. Dan's infamous.
I should probably stop using it at some point.
Well, we've heard you on the radio. Some folks may have heard you in an educative capacity, maybe explaining things through microphones on large boats, curing the sound, things like that. But it's pretty cool to finally be micro famous. I think Sam calls himself a femto celebrity, not even micro. So all of those teeny little recognitions, it does go a long way because we work hard at this, all of us here at Ask an Atheist. And so Dan, Josh, the last time all three of us were in the studio doing an episode was we were chewing the fat on January 13th.
Oh yes, right. I remember
good times.
This.
Chewing the fat soluble toxins.
Yeah, something like that. In a few weeks, I think that we'll be all gathering together with a lot of the Ask an Atheist crew and support members and family and extended family and friends for a Camp Quest Northwest planning retreat. And wanted to let folks know that Camp Quest Northwest still has space available for youth ages 8 to 17 at this summer's July session. Financial aid's available too. This is a secular sleepaway camp. We've talked about it a lot here on this show, and we've participated in Camp Quest Northwest for in various incarnations for basically since its inaugural summer. Parents can sign up their children at campquestnorthwest.org, and volunteer staff are also still being accepted for both sessions. So it's gratifying. It's amazing. It's really fun. Josh, you got any gems of wisdom about Camp Quest Northwest?
Yeah, no, it's a very fun experience. If you get a chance to go, if you're a kid, I'd highly recommend it. And also, if you get a chance to volunteer, it's awesome. It's a great experience. I've done it twice so far.
You're working really hard. You're working your tail off, but it's also a little bit of a chance for an adult to go to a sleepaway camp, too.
Yeah. I never got to experience camp as a kid, so this is actually a good way to actually do that.
What about you, Dan?
I did experience camp as a kid pretty much every summer from the time I was about 8 until I guess I was about 15. And honestly, you know, I have a lot of good summer camp memories, but my best summer camp memories are actually as a volunteer at Camp Quest Northwest. I will say that I have had more fun as an adult volunteer at Camp Quest Northwest than I had at 3 or 4 different summer camps as a kid.
And that's not just because the memories are a little bit more recent and potent, and as we age, our
childhood... No, you know, those camps had like dirt bikes and horses and stuff, and even still, Camp Quest with its modest kayaks, climbing wall, beaches, etc., still beats them out. So
I would say modest maybe is not quite the right adjective for describing the experience or facilities. I mean, it's amazing being there on the Sound in Bellingham Bay.
Absolutely.
For one of the locations. And we're super excited for one of our new locations at sharing space with Camp Waskowitz So a riparian environment, that's the riverbank, right, mm-hmm. along the rivers mm-hmm. and things like that. So you can have mountains or you can have ocean, and at Camp Quest Northwest, all of it. You know, summertime is kind of maybe around the corner, despite all the snow that we've been complaining about here. But we do have some feedback from a listener, David from Pennsylvania, who writes, listening to Ask an Atheist about snow on hilly, windy infrastructure made me think of snow here in Pittsburgh. Well, David from Pittsburgh, we wish you well with hopefully the turning of the corner into spring. I think we've got about 2 more weeks before that equinox. Is that right?
The daffodils are cracking the ground. That's the part that matters to me. That's when I call it spring. As soon as we have daffodil blooms that are not covered in snow, it is springtime.
It is. There's something really sad about seeing crocuses that are then sort of furling back together because they've got frost and snow on them and things like that. I did learn a really new vocabulary word. I'm a teacher. I teach many students who speak languages other than English or even Spanish. My favorite vocabulary word of the month is barf.
Go on.
Is barf. Barf is the Persian word for snow.
Oh.
And so I said, barf. Am I saying it right? Am I saying it correctly? And I have my four little students, and they're kind of giggling. And yes, yes. And one giggles more than the other. And really? Really? Barf? And they say, yes. Why? Why? You say it right. You say it right, miss. And I said, because you know what that means in English. And one of them giggles a little bit more shyly, whispers to her friends, and then everybody giggles a little bit less shyly. So I have decided that barf makes me barf. More, no more barf.
I'm just imagining the news stories. Barfmageddon 2019. Barfpocalypse.
Yes. And also, from the same derivation, you have, just as we have in English, snow cones, right? Snow cones is a treat.
No,
I'm dying.
But actually, there is a little a really amazing sweet treat that is usually white and made from sugar and things like that. And it's called barfi. And it's a treat in places that in sort of Central Asia and the Indian subcontinent and Pakistan and Afghanistan. So
I'm just glad that the barf pack in our mountains is being replenished.
Well, maybe there will be more glacial buildup, and we will have lots of barf that can then liquefy and replenish the entire river system of our state. Anyway. I think enough fun playing with language today. We have kind of some stories to talk about that do intersect with skepticism and atheism and humanism. And they, I guess, it just came to me, they're all focused on children. So whereas I am a teacher who does not participate in the religion of my Afghani students, we exchange vocabulary lessons, and I always like to learn from my students because they have an incredible amount of knowledge and wealth of experience that I don't share. And we can do that despite not sharing the same religion. Religion doesn't really come up between us, but not so for a teacher in Utah and her student. Because a Utah elementary teacher made a Catholic student wipe a ceremonial cross of ashes from his forehead this week after allegedly not understanding that the smudge was traditional for the start of Lent. Student William McLeod explained to his teacher that the marking was for a Catholic observance to celebrate being closer to God, but his teacher presented him with a wipe and instructed him to clean his face. Before the end of the school day, the teacher delivered an apology card and candy to the student. McLeod's parent actually questioned whether the teacher had read the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment relating to freedom of religion, to which she replied that she had not, according to the parent. A school district spokesperson stated that the teacher was under investigation for her actions. Now, initially, I was skeptical that there would be a teacher that it just wouldn't occur to them to ask about this. And if a student said that it had to do with their religion, just, okay, all right, cool. This is something I don't know. I'm not going to interfere with that. I was a little skeptical that the teacher wouldn't be aware of that. But I thought maybe that's because in my experience growing up as a student in New England and having extended family members who are Catholic, it's a common thing. Sure, when I was 5 years old, I thought it was weird. And I said, why is your face dirty? And then people explained it to me. And I said, oh, okay. And I understand in a pluralistic society, people have different practices. You wear different things. You do that on one day. That's great. Did you guys initially hearing the story think that maybe this teacher really did know and was sort of just doing an anti-Catholic thing?
No. I never even knew of this practice until I actually went to the East Coast in 2012.
Okay.
So, the practice of putting ash on your forehead is alien to me, and it sounds really dumb, but I understand, like, it's probably a religious thing, and we do have that kind of protection.
I encountered it quite a bit working in travel in the 2000s to about 2010. Pretty much every Ash Wednesday, you'd have passengers that had that marking on them, and we didn't care. Customs didn't care, so it wasn't really a thing. It was just sort of like, oh right, must be Ash Wednesday again. But I'll admit that when I was about 21 years old was probably the first time I'd ever encountered it, and it was with a passenger, and they did explain when I asked, and I said, oh, I guess I'm not familiar with that tradition. So
in Utah, it's not really known for having a very large Catholic population. You know, I mean, the largest religious group in Utah is LDS, Latter-day Saints. And so I could see maybe, you know, folks being skeptical that this teacher is so sheltered from a world experience that she wouldn't really know this. Maybe this was a malicious thing. But here's the thing. The teacher later, before the end of the school day, presented the child with a handwritten apology note. That's a very sweet thing to do. And as a teacher, you are wrong sometimes. You do mess up sometimes. I've written a note and delivered it to a student after I realized, you know what, I kind of called you out in the middle of class. Probably made you feel bad. I'm going to write a little note. I hope that we can, you know, communicate any of your concerns. And I'm really sorry about that. It's never my intention to make you feel badly. I want you to feel really welcome. If there's things that I can do, please let me know. Right? I've done that. The thing here in this story that makes me totally, completely believe that this teacher had no idea is that she gave candy to the kid. That's a kind of nice thing that motivates students and shows little children that you know, are still liking them, because children can say, maybe if a teacher made me feel bad, maybe it's because they don't like me, then that relational repair happens because I get candy. Yay! She doesn't know anything about Lent.
Right. Giving candy to a child at the beginning of Lent is one of the more diabolical tortures I could imagine.
Not only because you're supposed to give up one of your vices, right? But also because many observant Christians, and, you know, Ash Wednesday is observed by not just Catholics, but other, Protestant denominations. But many of them fast on that day. They abstain literally from eating. Now, usually with little kids, they don't do that. It's more, you know, an adult thing. But on the day that you're supposed to be a little bit solemn, it's starting this period of reflection. That would be like me making a gaffe with one of my Muslim students during the month of Ramadan and being like, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize that you wanted to stay in my classroom during the lunch period because it's hard to be in a cafeteria with a bunch of people eating French fries, right? I want to write this person a note and give them a treat. I want to give them a, you know, a granola bar and pudding pack, right?
A BLT.
Right?
Well, I mean,
because the bacon goes a long way with Muslim food.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So to me, I completely believe that this teacher had no idea about the Lenten traditions of Catholics.
Right. Sounds like she was just a little bit ignorant to it, not definitely trying to be an ash wipe.
No, she only offered that to the student for his forehead. Josh, you got further thoughts on this one?
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, you kind of touched on it before, but is it really a good idea to have a kid fasting? It does not seem like it's a very good idea, especially with kids that are growing up and they're... So, I mean...
That is one of the concerns that a lot of religions take into consideration. And in at least in my experience, dealing with pluralistic societies and the different ways that people observe their religious practices... A lot of times kids are not beholden to the same standards of fasting and abstinence right. from food on certain religious days that's expected of adults, and certainly not the infirm, certainly not, you know, pregnant women, things like that. But it is a good thing to kind of think about what's the motivation behind, you know, abstaining from that. And if you are making your kids do that, then maybe intervene a little bit. But if you're making your kid go to church at, you know, 7 a.m. before coming to school and smudging something on their forehead, that's a marking that you're part of this club and part of this group. It would be like saying, hey, rethink your kid wearing a yarmulke or a headscarf or a cross around her neck. I mean, I'm not going to get too down on all of those things, and it's one day.
Right. And I mean, also in the story, we find that this teacher wasn't familiar with the First Amendment either. So maybe the case is just that this teacher isn't particularly well read.
I would say start with the Constitution first, then broaden your perspectives a little bit by reading about some world religions. I get that you live in Mormon dominated Utah, but educate yourself a little bit, especially if you're a teacher, especially if you're going to be having students that, you know, after this day, you probably don't want to be in hot water with them, accidentally insulting them. I hope that you can wipe your slate clean and start learning. You're listening to Ask an Atheist. You can find us at atheist.radio. We'll be back after the break with some more things involving kids and school.
If you or a loved one have used any squid ink products, then you may be entitled to
addiction to the products,
growing squid arms,
going mentally insane,
losing friends and or family,
and certain death.
If you have been approached by and or seen members of the Squid Ink Corporation, please contact your local Inkerton Detective Agency immediately.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. You got me, Becky, today with Dan and Josh. And before the break, I said that we were going to continue talking about children. But that theme music says that it is time to talk about our best word segment, which, also has to do with talking about children. Speaking of children, let's talk about our president.
Oh!
kind of a little disaster, isn't he? Visiting disaster scenes. What am I getting at here? Well, Donald Trump signed Bibles and presented them to volunteers and congregants at a Baptist church who were participating in post-tornado cleanup and support. Trump addressed the Opelika, Alabama congregation, where he stated that FEMA was doing an A-plus job in the wake of tornadoes that have killed 23 people, and he said that he loved the state of Alabama.
Wow.
What? How much would you guys pay for a Trump-autographed Bible?
Can we do that in negative denominations?
You have to pay me to accept a copy of it?
I think I'd pay about $20 for one as a gift for Sam.
Just for shipping.
But yeah, I don't want one.
So here's the thing. Trump has a habit of like putting his name on things that he hasn't paid for, that don't really belong to him, that shouldn't be attributed to him. I don't really see this as out of line with any of his past behaviors.
No, not really.
Yeah, and he's also not the first president to sign Bibles. Reagan has done it, and so has George W. Bush.
Okay, all right. So kind of a thing. And I mean, we've signed Bibles and given them away. I don't know that any Bible reader would really appreciate that. Any Bible believer would appreciate that, but... You know, it's there. I mean, people write in their Bibles all the time. Believers are encouraged to note things and write down their family histories and trees and things like that, right?
I guess I would see this as kind of like, it would be like having Stephen Hawking sign your physics book. Hawking is a physicist. Maybe he did not write that book, but he is an expert in physicists. In physics. The Bible is a book of untruths, and Donald Trump is an expert in untruths.
Okay, so. That's one way to look at it.
There you go. I like that.
I worry, though, that this is Donald Trump thinking that he is the author of the Bible.
Well, he thinks it's probably about him, at least as far as like it works for his benefit.
Okay. I don't know if he's even that strategic. He could just fancy himself to be God, right? There's a lot of people that contend that Trump is a fake Christian and actually an atheist. Newsflash, you can't be an atheist if you believe in God. And if you believe you are God, you believe in God.
Right.
That's called autotheism.
Right. That's the cat religion.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Yes.
Do not degrade the status of cats by saying that they share anything in common with Donald Trump. I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. You know, I think saying to go into this church, yeah, when you have a place that's rural and is in the Bible Belt and it's been wrecked by a natural disaster, churches are going to be a natural gathering spot. But when Trump goes to a church, it's not because people are naturally gathering there. It's because he's playing to, you know, the Baptist evangelical base. Mm-hmm. The volunteers that were there that pushed their, you know, gave their kids a little push and said, "Will you sign my Bible, Mr. Trump? You know, Mr. President?" And they were so proud and beaming. They literally said, "We think Trump coming to our church is a godsend."
Yeah.
What's he gonna do? Your town was wrecked by tornadoes. Why is that what you're asking God to send you? If you believe in God, why do you want Trump to come there. Wouldn't you want, like, infrastructure or, I don't know, like, relief supplies or trailers of, like, food and bottled water?
Well, if he thinks he's God, this is him acknowledging their suffering.
Oh, okay, all right. I want him to acknowledge my suffering under his presidency.
All right, at least he came down there quickly. Meanwhile, in Puerto Rico.
Yeah. What parts of Puerto Rico are still without power and infrastructure?
And just turned down a proposal for a $600 million aid, saying that Puerto Rico would just use it to pay off their national debt. Once again, showing that he is not aware that Puerto Rico is, in fact, part of the United States.
There's people that speak lots of languages other than English there. And that must mean to Trump that... Yeah, there's a lot of things in those that Trump cerebrum of untruths, as you know, you alluded to earlier, he's a man of untruths, that just is, some of it is very startling, like a denial of aid or support to Puerto Rico, but yet in places where people can and will vote for him, you know, a huge pandering and saying, let's get things in immediately. But there's also the funny things, like... I don't know that he really understands that he didn't write the Bible. I mean, he says that he wrote the Art of the Deal, whereas that's ghostwritten for him.
Right.
I mean,
maybe the Bible was wholly ghostwritten for him.
Perhaps. Ooh, that's a good one, Dan. But here's the thing. Also, I got to credit James Corden with this one. I think he's on the Late Late Show. Trump gets some things mixed up in his mind. So... It's conceivable that maybe he's a little bit mixed up and thinks that he's God. But at the same time, he got mixed up when talking about Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, and he referred to him as Tim Apple. And that would be like, I forget Becky's last name, and so I just call her Becky Teacher or Becky Spanish. And James Corden says what this indicates is that we are certain at this time now that Donald Trump thinks his name has been changed to Donald President.
Well, I mean, Donald Trump names everything after himself, so he kind of expects every company to be along the lines. Like, there's somebody that's at the top of the corporation that has to take credit for the entire entity.
If you are prone to confusion, people keep calling you Mr. President, you might just assume that your last name had been changed without anyone telling you.
Or that that's just part of the, you know, the part of the deal, if you will, that once you get sworn in, that, oh, your name changes, you know. Sometimes when Melania married him, part of the deal was that she would have her last name changed. So when ceremonial things happen, I guess it comes with a name change. I wouldn't put it past him to believe that. I wouldn't put it past him to have... one of his aides have a bet, or two of his aides to have a bet that they told him that. And let's see how long it can be where he believes that that's the case. We had this big ceremony, so his name's has changed. Yeah. So, you know, he goes down to the Bible Belt. He's in a church. Yes, there were incredibly destructive tornadoes. We've seen, we've had folks on the show that have had their homes destroyed and lives destroyed by tornadoes. The force of tornadoes can be incredibly destructive. And that's terrible. But do we need to have religious pandering going on at the same time? To me, I think that I'd rather not receive a Bible, not receive a signature, but receive actual, tangible rebuilding support in the face of devastation like that. So let's see. Let's go to some feedback from a listener called E, who calls themselves E. And E is questioning about whether God is real. Now, in our minds, I mean, we get that. We're atheists here. You know, listen to Ask an Atheist. So we're not going to operate under the assumption that God is real, despite what Donald Trump may say. So E writes, I always believed in Jesus as my Lord and Savior since I was a child. I'm a nurse, but when one of my patients died, a beam of blue sapphire light came through the ceiling of the room and went directly onto my patient. Then I saw my patient's soul come out of his body. It looked identical to him, same haircut and style. Then his eyes opened and looked up at the beam of light, and he started to go up in the beam of light towards the ceiling. Then the light disappeared. The whole thing happened in about 8 seconds. There is a God, people, and Jesus is Lord God. Before that all happened, I called on Jesus to help me and my patient. Then it all happened in 3D, 1 to 2 feet from my eyes. I have never had an experience like that before that or since that time. How do you explain that? Josh, you want to take this one first? Take a crack?
I explain it by, please don't be my nurse ever.
You want the nurse to be fully capable and competent?
I kind of want my nurse and doctors to actually have like a grounding in reality.
So if you feel like you need God's help to save your patient, maybe your training is not great enough or competent enough to be Josh's nurse. So take note, everyone. All Dan, right. What's your thoughts? This blue light, can you explain this scientifically?
Kind of. So she said that she'd never seen something like this before or since. So how do you explain that? And that it hasn't happened before or since and that this isn't really a common occurrence kind of tells me that this isn't the norm. From that, I'd like to get into one of the scientific principles. The thing should be replicable. If this was something that happened regularly, we would be seeing it. We would see it everywhere. We would know about it. It would be a huge social trope. I've witnessed the deaths of three persons personally, and none of them had this happen. So I'm 3 for 3 on no sapphire lights coming through the ceilings or the sky, since two of them were outside. And souls leaving bodies, etc. We haven't been seeing this. And even still, this nurse who ostensibly works in a place where you would see people die with fairly frequently, at least, if she's never seen this before or since, that still kind of flies in the face of things being replicable in order to be true. We're not seeing this. This was a one-time deal. So I would ask this nurse, how do you explain this? How come you have only seen this once? Why doesn't it happen every time a patient dies? Do you only pray for some patients? Was this the only time that you've prayed for a patient, and this is the only time that this has happened? Or is it possible that this could be a distorted memory, that this could be an hallucination, this could be something related to the trauma of watching people die over and over? There's a million other explanations for it besides that people get absorbed by beams of blue light. In fact, that's kind of a common UFO trope. How do we know that this person wasn't abducted by aliens at the moment of their death?
How do we know that the aliens that allegedly abducted this person aren't God, Lord Jesus? How do we know that the sapphire lights weren't actually just the operating theater lights, which can be very, very bright, maybe moving and shifting as you're trying to hurriedly help this patient not perish and die and expire on the table in front of you? How do we know that the face mask shield doesn't have a reflection of the same guy in a different angle? How do we know that maybe you weren't stressed and had tears in your eyes that created a little double vision there? All of those things are things that come to my mind. Josh, you got any other explanations? Or are you going with UFO?
I'm going with UFO. I think this is ET going home, and he just does. I mean, so we're talking about like kind of some Stargate philosophy. I mean, basically a philosophy of Stargate where like he ascended.
Okay.
He became an ascended being.
All right. All right. Thanks. Atheist Josh that now believes in ascended beings per sci-fi networks programming circa 2006.
I think the simplest explanation is probably one that is commonly known. Hospital workers, due to the conditions of their work, are famously overstressed and underslept. This could very well be just a manifestation of that.
I'd go simpler and say maybe they're making this up.
Also possible.
The other thing is that how you explain this, E, from the internet, you said, my explanation is Jesus. What? Why Jesus. Does this, what, doing what? I mean, why is the sky blue? Jesus. Why does my food taste funny today? Jesus. Why did I have a seizure? Jesus. That's not an explanation that is going to be satisfactory to someone who is scientifically minded, someone who finds value in understanding the reality of our world through empirical evidence that, as you said, Dan, is replicable. And just because someone else attests to the same experience doesn't mean that the incident, the phenomenon that you describe or possibly making up, has been replicated. It just means the storytelling has been replicated. You know, Josh, I think that I'm a little bit more convinced. I think that this is a made-up thing. I think, you know, especially when we're telling stories that are high-stress stories and high-emotional impact stories, we want to believe that something is there because the death of someone is disrupting. It's shattering. It's shaking. And so when you have something to explain that death, then I get that. I also do not appreciate, though, using that high emotional and high impact event and phenomenon and natural human reaction as a way to push your God to someone else. And I think that that's one of the ways that you're gonna get pushback and saying, you know what, this, in terms of asking for an explanation, we can go the rational route and say, here are all the different possible explanations. But we can also look at, you're using emotions to try and push your God. I'm going to use emotions right back at you and say, I think this is baloney and I don't appreciate you using that. This is Ask an Atheist at Atheist.radio. I think we will come back after the break to truly talk about some actual chronological children.
Tell you what happened to Danny Jackson Cupcakes. At age 7, he fell off of his bike and scraped his leg. Afterward, a salesman came up to him and offered a squid ink bandage. He accepted, and after 2 weeks, his poor leg had fallen off.
So, if your loved one has suffered the horrible side effects of squid ink, please call 1-800-ANTI-SQUID INK. That is 1-800-ANTI-SQUID INK.
Warning, recipients are non-existent. Please do not call number.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I got a little bit heated in that last segment. Let's go to something to cool me down. Like tetanus. Yum, yum. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently released a report on the expenses and procedures related to treating tetanus in one unvaccinated 6-year-old child from Oregon. The boy had contracted the disease from a cut, which was cleaned and stitched at home. Within 6 days, he had trouble breathing, muscle spasms, and lockjaw. The boy was airlifted and hospitalized for 57 days to the tune of more than $800,000, excluding transport and post-hospital rehabilitation. A child with tetanus shot, which is combined with diphtheria and whooping cough vaccines, costs about, $30, if you don't pay with insurance.
In which case, it's probably free.
So we talk about how much science, how much robust data there is to support the importance of vaccines and the efficacy and the benefit of vaccines. And that might not sound like a religious or atheist issue, but when so many people either choose not to vaccinate their children for religious reasons, that's a religious and atheist issue, or they choose not to vaccinate their children because they don't understand the science or they just discount it or disagree with it. That's an issue of both secular humanism, when you're promoting human flourishing, which isn't going to happen when the kids are dying of tetanus, or measles or any other contractible disease. And it's also an issue that applies to the rational minds of individuals, whether you're atheist or not. Dan, this tetanus, it sounds pretty nasty.
Yeah, it is. So tetanus is caused by a bacterial infection from Clostridium tetani. It produces a toxin that causes muscle contractions, or more specifically, interferes with normal muscle activity. It usually sets in within 3 to 10 days, but it can actually incubate for as long as 90 days. So if you have a wound that you may have gotten from a sharp object, especially a puncture wound from something that was unclean or outside, it's really not enough to just sit around and be like, oh, well, it's been a week and I didn't get tetanus. Well, you still could. Even still, tetanus is very rare in the United States because, well, we've done a very good job of vaccinating against it. It is most common in places that are sort of warmer and humid, where there's a lot more stuff in the soil. But don't let that deter you if you live in one of our northern temperate climates, like, say, the state of Washington or the state of Oregon, where I believe this one occurred. Because tetanus is still present in soil, it's still present in things that are decomposing, it's even present in human saliva, which is one of the reasons that any hospital worker will tell you human bites are some of the dirtiest and most dangerous bites to treat.
Okay, all right. So all good reasons to get a tetanus shot. Either have it already in your system and or get it, get another booster shot if you might come into contact with something that might suggest exposure.
Yeah, it's not just a good idea. It can actually be a very terminal idea. Even with modern treatment, about 10% of people who contract tetanus, even in the United States where we have excellent medical care, still die.
So this little boy, 57 days in a hospital, It seems like it might have been touch and go for a while there. If you're in there for so long, it's those muscle contractions that you're talking about interfering with regular muscles. Muscles like, oh, I don't know, a diaphragm or a heart?
Yes. Yeah, they can interfere with your diaphragm. I don't think they get into the heart, but they can certainly stop you breathing. The contractions can actually be strong enough, hard enough to fracture bone and rip tendons from their anchorage points.
Oh, poor baby. Thinking about this, you
wanted
to your child, your six-year-old, be healthy. So you decided not to vaccinate them because you thought that that would help them stay healthy. Meanwhile, your kid ends up in the hospital for 2 months.
Cramping so hard that they can break their own spine. Yes.
So this is a real tough one. And I think, Josh, you brought this to my attention initially, sort of in show research for this week. What drew you to this particular thing?
I mean, it's just a continuation of the same story that we've been talking about forever, is anti-vaccination campaigns that are going on are actually devastating people that it's hurting children the most. And I don't want to be I mean, it's children that are going to suffer the most.
Speaking of children, we're actually going to bump all the way over to another, you know, temperate environment where these kids were not at risk of tetanus. But in New York, back in February, a New York Supreme Court judge ruled in favor of a school district that barred two teenage girls from going to school due to their immunization status. The girl's mother had stated that she had applied for religious exemption from vaccination requirements in her previous residence of Seneca, but was unaware that she had to reapply when they moved to Orchard Park. The family argues that they are part of the Temple of the Inner Flame Church, which does not condone vaccination. The students have been out of school since November of last year, and the Orchard Park School District is not supplying the family with school materials to ensure that the teens don't fall behind. An attorney for the schools argued that student health and safety are taken incredibly seriously in Orchard Park. This is kind of a complex one, because when you say, don't come to school because you're not safe to be around our staff, other students, we need to ensure public health, but at the same time, not provide for the constitutionally required educative services for teens, that's a tough one. I'm conflicted on this one as an educator.
Yeah, it's not completely straightforward, because I think New York state law does allow for the exemptions as long as they're applied for. With that being said, it's really devastating. Like, you should probably find a new religion if it's against vaccinations. I mean, this goes to what's the harm of religion? And people are like, what's the harm of my beliefs? Well, this is proof one of what's the harm of believing something that has no basis in reality.
I think also when you're looking at New York State, you know, they do, like Washington, allow for exemptions from the vaccine requirements if it's your sincere religious beliefs that vaccines are against your religion. That's still allowed in like 32 states. You know, yeah. Washington State was really working towards trying to eliminate a personal philosophical exemption and saying, well, if you take exception with vaccines because of an established religion, cool. But if you take exception from vaccines because of your own personal belief that you found in an internet comment forum, then we want to do away with that. Washington still allows that. New York State still allows for religious individuals to say no more. But this case is new. It sets precedent. It seems to set precedent because it said that, all right, the Seneca schools, they accepted your religious exemption. Cool. This new one that said, no, not good enough. You didn't fill out the paperwork, or you filled it out wrong. She says she applied for one, and then, no, kids can't come to school. And the court said, yeah, that's okay. That's fine for the school to do that. Doesn't look like it's a procedural thing that, you know, court judge says, just go fill out the right paperwork, and then you can send your kids to school. Saying, no, that's fine. They're okay to be barred from school. And that, I would imagine, is going to set up some battles between the courts and the legislative areas within New York State to say which one is right. You know, was the ruling right? Does the law have to be changed because of this judge's ruling? Is it going to go to appeals courts? Is someone trying to push it all the way to Supreme Courts to say that anything that says in any state that public health is less important than someone's religious belief? You know, are there people trying to do that? Because that's something that I fear. Do you guys fear that? That, you know, a U.S. Supreme Court ruling is going to say public health is only second to someone's religious belief?
Every decision that comes from the current configuration scares me.
Dan, what about you?
Well, what I've seen in the last 15 or so years here in the Northwest is a huge rise in the number of hospitals that are Catholic run. And while this isn't exactly a legislative thing, it does have a very real effect on the rights of patients and the kind of treatment that they can receive. And I do find that terrifying, particularly for female patients. There's a lot of reproductive health issues that are not supported by Catholic hospitals or that are outright turned down by Catholic hospitals, meaning that somebody cannot seek the hospital in their community, that they may have to go a huge distance to get the kind of care that they need. And I want to be clear, I'm not even talking about abortive services here. I'm talking about general birth control services. I'm talking about preventive examinations. A lot of those are not accepted by Catholic hospitals. So seeing that on a local level is frightening. Imagining that on a federal level is terrifying.
So I think that what we have here is a lot of things at issue where we have the confluence of folks that think that public health should be supreme and folks that think that religious rights or religious beliefs should supersede any of that public health. I don't think that you can have a pluralistic society of human flourishing, regardless of, you know, whatever the beliefs may be, if you say that an individual's religion supersedes public health. That's where my opinion lies. And I, too, am afraid of what it looks like at individual state levels and at the federal level, because we see so much push at local and federal levels to say that religion rules supreme, whatever it might be. And of course, you know, say, well, it's religious freedom in general, but which religion in particular is the one that's always favored by these folks that are pushing for these laws? I think that we can, you know, wink, wink, know that. It's, you know, if someone has a minority religious view, they're generally not favored. They're generally not thought of in the, well, we want to have religious freedom to discriminate. We want to have religious freedom to enforce our laws at you know, levels of hierarchy. But speaking of minority religions and healthcare, I want to bring us still in New York, where a woman is facing felony charges related to helping Mennonite women birth their children at home. Police assert that Elizabeth Catlin misrepresented herself as a licensed midwife, created an unlicensed medical practice for which she fraudulently accepted money, and endangered both women and babies. She is also under investigation for involvement in the death of a hospital-delivered newborn whose mother was brought in by Catlin after struggling during labor. Most of the Mennonite women who Catlin attended to typically shun hospitals, health insurance, and modern technology and live in rural counties with few certified midwives and obstetric specialists. Josh, you also kind of flagged this as something that's of interest and kind of a little odd thing here.
Yeah, the fact that she's going around and presenting herself as a licensed professional is really troubling. They do. So the Mennonites are known to shun medical services. And so, I mean, by actually putting herself in that place, she's furthering their biases against medical, any medical service.
I think also it does kind of have a confluence of an individual's right with their healthcare here, because there has been a medicalization of the birth process and the prenatal process. And we see some places where women can be, you know, threatened with, you know, involuntary hospitalization because they want to have their child at home or in a birth center, and you're forcing that woman to then go into a hospital. And that's a tough situation for me, sort of philosophically, when I look at, you know, whether a woman should have autonomy over her body. To me, we're not looking at communicable diseases. So we're not impacting public health in a broad way in that respect with communicable diseases. It's a statistic of public health if you look at, you know, labors in certain contexts. You can look at that from a statistics perspective and say which kind of births are safer or have better outcomes for children and things like that once they're born. But until a woman gives birth, my view as an atheist is that she is an autonomous being. She can decide if she wants to have a home birth or a midwifing center birth or go in the Puget Sound to have her baby or go to the Catholic hospital or go to a non-affiliated, you know, hospital. And midwives, doulas, people that attend the birth and attend to the mother, that's an important part of lots of cultures and the human experience. So I appreciate that this woman, who isn't even a Mennonite herself, is looking at an underserved population, right? And might be saying, you know what, I want to attend their births and I want to help these women through something they're not well served. One, because of their beliefs. Two, because they live in rural areas where there aren't really doulas and midwives that go around. And I can appreciate that perspective. And I can appreciate the religious autonomy of these women also that say, I want to have my birth at home and have my, you know, 11 children attended to by another woman that helps out like a second mother. That's cool. I would rather their kids get vaccinated, which I think actually Mennonites and Amish are cool with vaccines in general.
Yeah.
But for someone to be sort of misrepresenting and presenting themselves in an inauthentic way, I think is taking advantage of someone because of their religious beliefs. And just as I don't want a religious person emotionally manipulating, you know, atheists to say, go believe in God, I don't want someone who isn't part of that religion taking advantage of a religious community's belief to present themselves as something they're not, especially when it comes to health and medicine.
Especially if they're going to do it for money.
Yes, absolutely. If you were saying this is a vocation, this is a calling, I'm retired, I want to go around and help these women and just like have a female-centered, you know, birthing party and then help with the swaddling and things like, okay, that's cool. All right. You know, go do that. That's cool. That's a, you know, female empowerment thing. I think that most of the time you know, especially in Mennonite communities where women are kind of second class to men, like that's kind of a neat way to exert your sort of, you know, authority, autonomy, and power, and sisterhood, if you will.
Right.
Within that context, if you're going to choose to be part of that context, not in a way that's going to threaten kids.
And I don't believe there's any laws prohibiting a person from offering to help out, provided they're not claiming to be something. You know.
Yeah, the expertise. They're trying to claim themselves to be an expert and when they are not.
Yeah, or when they haven't gone through a licensing procedure to verify that they have minimal qualifications. You know, I mean, we've seen that children can be very dirty. we have elementary school teachers wanting them to wipe off their faces. We have children playing in mud and accidentally getting tetanus, right? There is a reason that before labor, pregnant women get a tetanus booster shot because there's a lot of points of entry and wounds that can happen during the birthing process and you don't want to get tetanus. So I think that this is an interesting case. And anytime that you're dealing with, with children in a vulnerable spot, I think that it's definitely a hot button issue. So I'd like to see how this further investigation and how her trial kind of unfolds. We have a listener, Gideon, who asks, do you think it would do more harm or good if everybody spontaneously learned the truth about all religions all at once? Something like a hive mind info dump, even if it turned out that one of the religions out there was actually right.
Yeah, that would be, I mean, you can't really come up with an answer with that without knowing exactly what the supposed outcome is going to, I mean, what the supposed truth is.
Okay, let me posit this. So all of a sudden, all humans got the answer to, is God real? Does God exist? Which religion is right? And say that the answer was the Mennonite religion. All of their beliefs about God, that's the one, that's the truth. Okay, do you think that would do more harm or more good if all of us just came to understand that all of a sudden, all at once?
There would be a shock to the system that would be devastating, I think, because too many people would want still hold to their own ideals. And so they wouldn't want to go to become a Mennonite.
So you'd think that there would be a backlash against that?
No, there'd be a massive backlash.
Okay.
Well, on the other side, if everybody just sort of accepted that, oh, all right, well, the Mennonite religion is true. Wow, what would that do to our society? No more internet, no more podcasts, no more radio shows, cars. Do we go back to horses and carriages? We start having unlicensed personnel attend our births in our homes.
Okay, so let me put another one out there. Do you think it would do more harm or more good if everyone spontaneously learned through a hive mind info dump that there is no God? that we as atheists say, oh, we were the ones that were correct. You know, we as atheists, I don't know, but I operate under the assumption, and I understand that that's not my knowledge, but it's my belief that there isn't a God and supernatural stuff doesn't happen. What if that was the thing that was revealed to everybody? And would that do more harm? You think there would still be a backlash?
Oh, yeah. Because people care more about beliefs than knowledge. They will still hammer down on their beliefs.
Ooh, I don't see Exhibit 1, Donald Trump. Yeah. Dan, what do you think?
I would say initially, tremendous harm. And in the long term, tremendous good. The initial tremendous harm would be for pretty similar reasons that Josh is talking about. Except that I would say that religion does do some things right. It's great for organizing. It's great for outreach. It's great for building community.
Do you think that happens because there's some inherent greatness or because there's some coercive pressure?
No.
Coercive pressure.
I think there's coercive pressure, but there's also kind of a tradition of community building. While I was sort of seeking, I went to several churches that, while they really didn't strike me as something that I wanted to do, seemed like relatively healthy environments with vibrant communities of people who could rely on each other in an emergency. These are some of the things that I think religion gets right. And if all of a sudden we all know that every religion is false, we might start to see some of those support systems and communities disintegrate in the short term. Maybe in the long term, we'll see them be rebuilt on principles of reason, on principles of science, on principles of humanism. But in the short term, I think we would see tremendous despair, tremendous destruction.
I think what we would see is that those systems of being able to rely on someone in times of emergency, being able to congregate and share meals and share experiences and share from each other and storytell and create art, those are not inherent to religion. And I think that those are a cultural patrimony embedded within humanity. And you don't need a church organization to form that. So if there is no church, how then do you have the infrastructure to form that? And how can we form that? And I think that's a personal directive from a humanist perspective that I sort of take on and I ponder on when I look at my philosophy, when I say, what if I don't have the religion, I don't have my weekly gatherings, what am I going to be doing to create that community?
I have a great suggestion. Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org.
Okay.
Currently accepting donations and volunteers. I'm
very
serious,
fair.
Though. This is a great way to build community. We are a place where kids can go and make friends who have similar beliefs and have good adult role models with similar beliefs, and they do build lasting community.
Okay. I'm going to bring this actually to another listener's inquiry. This is Laura from Falls Church, Virginia, who writes, can we create an official atheist holiday where we can get off work that's protected by freedom of religion? So this is kind of a cool thing because this has already been done, Laura. Just not here. Not in Falls Church, Virginia, as far as I know. But when you have communities that are intentional and intentionally congregate or have some shared set of beliefs, to some governing bodies, it doesn't matter whether those beliefs are not supernatural. So a few years ago now, maybe 5 or 6, we covered on Ask an Atheist, this program, that in Germany, on June 21st, when school is presumably in session, I believe it was for them at that time, the humanist children were granted exemption from going to school on that day, and it was not considered a skip day. It wasn't considered an unexcused absence. It was considered an absence due to religious and cultural observance, because humanists throughout the world, as sort of a cohesive, a nascent organization, you know, we have a small little deficit in terms of being recognized gathered humans. I mean, a lot of the religions have a big jump on us, right? Been around for like 6,000, 4,000, 2,000, 1,000 years. But June 21st on the June solstice is considered World Humanism Day. And on the Northern Hemisphere's winter solstice on December 20th or 21st is considered Human Light. So instead of saying the light that draws us out of the darkness at that solstice, at that winter solstice, into the spring, Doesn't have to be supernatural. Doesn't have to be linked to any miracle of oil lasting days on a menorah or any candles on a Christmas tree or any Yule log burning to the, you know, none of that has to be supernatural. It can be recognizing the light of humanity and light of humans. Now, those are very northern centric holidays, because if they're in December, well, it's our winter solstice up here. It's not the winter solstice down there. So I'd like to see those flipped, right? But human light being sort of the altering anchoring holiday is something that you can adopt. And I think, Laura, that it really could be cool to test that in a case, either with your employer. If your employer rejects it, you know, ask your employer. Don't go straight to suing and saying, I want my religion recognized, because you're not gonna have standing. Who knows? You say, you know what, I've got an important cultural holiday event that has to do with my particular worldview, my cosmology community. Maybe your boss will say, yeah, sure, take it as your personal day, just like so-and-so has taken Good Friday as their personal day. So I don't know. What do you guys think about that one? Atheist holidays.
I mean, it's an answer to one of the common religious arguments. Is religious people all the time say, well, if God's not real or anything like that, then why do we have all these days dedicated to him?
So, because humans dedicated those gods.
Right. So, we also have a President's Day. We even have a Columbus Day, and he turned out to be kind of a...
not great character?
Kind of an ash wipe.
Indeed. So does it mean that in order for you to be real and become real like a velveteen rabbit, you just have to establish some holidays, and there you are. You're real. We've really finally made it on the world stage. We've got, you don't need churches, you just need an atheist holiday. Josh, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dan.
Pleased to be here.
Our music is by Chris Coleman and Phil Whitfield. Writing assistant today was Alex Reese. You can find us at atheist.radio. We answer questions when you email us questions@atheist.radio. Find us on Twitter at AskAnAtheistWA. Facebook at the same place. We'll see you guys.